Itt hagyom, hogyha ezt szabad.
Thank you, Imre. So we're going to talk about human brain imaging, and in particular about functional magnetic resonance imaging. So if the terminology is not clear or you can follow something, just please stop me and ask questions, okay? It's important that we can, or you can keep track of what I'm saying. So the outline of my talk is going to have three parts. We'll talk about the human MRI methods. MRI is the magnetic resonance imaging. If there is an F that says that it's functional magnetic resonance imaging, then I will talk about the application of fMRI in cognitive neuroscience, and then we'll talk about more clinical and translational. Translational research means that pharmacological research where you try to bridge the gap between the animal models and human models in the development of different pharmacological agents. So, what is MRI? So, basically MRI is a very diverse methodology based on the magnetic resonance imaging, and it has a large part which is concerned about the anatomy of the brain or of the other tissues in the body. We are talking of focusing on the brain, and structure imaging means basically that you are studying or you are making pictures of the anatomy of the human brain in vivo. That means that imaging is not harmful, it doesn't have any isotopes, so MRI is a very important method because it's completely non-invasive and you can visualize the structure or the anatomy of the human brain with a very good resolution. I mean good resolution considering that it's a non-invasive method. Then there is a second part of the imaging methods which are functional imaging, and there is the dominant and most important method is the blood oxygen level dependent MRI contrast. We will talk about this later a lot. But functional imaging means that you can study or you can investigate the function of the brain using MRI. That means that you give a task for the patient or the participant and you are trying to see what are the brain areas which are engaged in processing of this stimuli or doing this task. And that's an absolutely unique feature of this method because there are no other ways to study in vivo human brain functions functionally. There is the PET, the positron emission tomography, but you all know probably that it actually requires an injection of an isotope, so therefore it's basically not allowed to use just purely in the research environment, and there always has to be an indication, clinical indication, why to use PET. So if you want to do just lar-to-lar imaging or functional imaging, then you have to do fMRI basically nowadays. And then you can look for the chemistry of the brain using the spectroscopy. It's a very exciting technique. You can basically label different compounds in the brain and study the concentration of these compounds, so it's a spectroscopy. The only problem that you have a very poor resolution. This means that the volume you are investigating is 1 cm by 1 cm by 1, so it's a very large voxel, as we say. There is pixel when you talk about 2 dimensions and voxels if you talk about 3 dimensions. So these are the 3 big parts of the imaging field, and we are going to focus now on the functional imaging because that's really unique for the MRI methods. Yeah, so as I mentioned, it's the most dominant and most advanced functional imaging is fMRI. So it has a wide application field in cognitive neuroscience. So you can study the different cognitive function in the brain like memory, attention, vision, sensory processing. There is a strong application in clinical research. You know all the neuropsychiatric disorders are very complex. They affect the whole brain, the whole network. So the only way you can study it is if you can simultaneously measure activations in the whole brain, in the whole network, and that's exclusively can be done only with fMRI. And then there is the pharmacological translational research application, what I already mentioned. So in the development of different pharmaceutical agents or medication, different molecules, you have to keep track of what's going on in the human brain. There were a lot of failures in the development of drugs for central neuronal system. This is because in models, in animal models, they work pretty good. So you can induce now schizophrenia in a rat. You can treat this schizophrenia in the rat, but then you have a compound, you have a drug, then you inject it in the human. It turns out that it doesn't pass even the blood-brain barrier and it cannot affect the human brain as it was supposed to be based on the animal model. So it's a very critical question now how to improve the translation, the gap, to reduce the gap between animal models and human models in the pharmaceutical research. So that's the third big application. So as I said, it's non-invasive. So there is no proven fact that MRI can anyway affect your health or your basically your physiology in a sustained way. So there are now experiments which require for a subject to go to the scanner and make an MRI examination every day for a year. So basically 300 examinations, and there is no proof of any effects of the MRI. That makes it applicable in the infant studies. So basically the MRI is the only method which can be used now for newborn babies. If there is a problem with asphyxia, you know, if there is a shortage of oxygen during the birth, then you have to somehow investigate these babies, see how this, you know, affected the brain function and how it affected the brain tissue itself. And the only non-invasive way you can do it is with fMRI. So it's again a very important application of the fMRI. Now it has a, we say it's very high resolution, but of course now, before you heard a lot of talks or lectures on neuroanatomy and neurophysiology where you are talking about cells and synapses, but that can be done only in animal preparations or animal models. So in humans nowadays, you can do only this resolution. Now it has been reduced. I will talk about this in the end of my talk. There are some very interesting developments. So basically, this can be reduced to 1 millimeter, and that goes beyond below 1 second, the subsequent resolution of sampling. This is spatial resolution, this is temporal sampling, or how often you can repeat a measurement. The TR, the repetition time. And as I already mentioned, the very critical feature of this technique is that it can simultaneously image the whole brain. Now, it's absolutely important. It was recognized quite recently only because, you know, there were these models of different disease or cognitive functions, and people were trying, or researchers were trying to focus down on a specific region in the brain, say hippocampus. You probably heard a lot about hippocampus on this course, and then try to connect all the functions, all the impairments, what they see, to this specific structure or a specific molecule like dopamine. It's a critical and very important chemical compound in the brain, but still, now we already know that you have to take care, or you have to watch the whole brain working in order to understand how the whole network is affected by the different disease or different conditions. So again, this is fMRI, which can give you this whole brain picture, what is required. So this is a very important feature. Now, the strongest disadvantage of this technique is that it doesn't measure directly the brain, the neuronal activity. So it's not like electrophysiology that you put an electrode close or within the cell and you try to record the electric activity from a cell, and that gives you a direct measure of the neural activity. fMRI measures the bold signal, which is the indirect measure of the neural activity, and we will go back to this in the next slide. What is it exactly? So this technique has been described by Ogawel and his co-workers in 1990. And since that, this is one of the biggest breakthroughs, and of course you have thousands and thousands of publications nowadays using this method. And basically you measure this with a specific contrast, the T2 star contrast, and this bold signal, the blood oxygen level, oxygenation level dependent contrast, is actually measuring the balance or the relative concentration of the desoxygenated and oxygenated hemoglobin in the brain. This is because the oxygenated hemoglobin is paramagnetic and oxygenated is diamagnetic. And this contrast, this T2 weighted contrast, is very sensitive to the magnetic field inhomogeneity in the brain, in the tissue, and as long as this relative concentration of balance is changing, there will be a change in the homogeneity of the magnetic field, and this is actually what is measured. So when there is a neural activity, there is going to be increased supply of oxygenated blood to that region of the brain, and that will actually induce a change in the homogeneity of the tissue. So this is indirect, and it depends on a lot of factors. It depends on what is the oxygen consumption, what is the blood flow volume, and how is the microstructure of the vessels in that region. So there is a very complex signal that you get in the blood, but you can measure it very consistently. And this you have to keep in your mind always when you try to interpret results of the fMRI experiment. So I will tell you, but even though it's so indirect and it's so complex, now we know a lot about how it is generated, how it can be connected to real neural signals. And the first study, and very important study, was by Logothetis and co-workers back in 2001, when they made preparations of, these were animal preparations, monkeys, and they measured simultaneously electrophysiology and Bolt signal. And what they found actually, and that was very important, that the Bolt signal is closely correlates with the local field potential in that region where you measure the Bolt. Now, I don't know whether you know what is local field potential, but that basically reflects the synaptic activity in that region. So it's, again, local field potential is very complex signal, but at least you can say that this Bolt signal now is related or closely associated with the synaptic activity in that region. So you are not measuring the output, say you have area A and area B. So when you have a higher increase in area B, which is connected to area A, then you probably measure an input to this region from area A to B, where there is going to be a lot of synaptic activity. And you are not measuring directly much of the output of this region. Now, yes, what I just summarized, you can see it here. So it's basically the local intracortical processing what you measure with this. You cannot differentiate whether there is this is an excitatory or an inhibitory activity. So that's again a problem, but you can cope with it. Now, and also an important consideration here is that this Bolt signal is going to be very, very sensitive for the global neuromodulatory signals in the brain, which are like dopamine or serotonin. So you know all these compounds or neurotransmitters affect globally the brain signal and brain processing, and that modulation is going to be captured very nicely by fMRI. Which is good because all the pharmaceutical agents which are now basically on the market and which are developed now for brain disease, they somehow affect this big dopaminergic or serotonergic or cholinergic system in the brain. So that makes it this method very suitable for research in pharmaceutical respect. So, yeah. So we have now very sophisticated experiments which also try to connect the Bolt signal with some electrophysiological, you know, phenomena. And basically this is one of the biggest advances that came out in 2010 in Nature. You probably heard about optogenetics. So now you can combine optogenetics with fMRI in animal models in rat fMRI, and there was a very nice demonstration that there is a very nice correlation or association between the neural activity of the principal cells of a, say, a motor cortical region and the fMRI activity, what is recorded from that place. So now we have a lot of evidence showing that, yes, the Bolt activity that you measure in humans. So you cannot perform these experiments in humans, of course. You cannot put an electrode into the head of a human. So these are very, very important confirmative studies showing that how the Bolt signal is connected or associated with. This is another nice example that has been done on monkey models using monkey electrophysiology and fMRI. It actually used the intrinsic signal, optical imaging technique. What they showed that you can basically differentiate the driving, the spiking activity, and the modulatory activity in the brain, and you can connect it to different components of the Bolt signal. So basically the strongest is the modulational signal, what I already mentioned. Now, if you just summarize this first part about the Bolt technique is that, yes, it's very effective, it's very good and very important, and we know now a lot about its neural background. the most important thing is that it is not very well suited to measure, of course, very transient small event in the brain, because we are talking about the temporal resolution of 1 second. But it's nicely, and it can be nicely applied to study larger neuromodulatory changes in the brain, which are associated with very, very different, you know, cognitive behavior and clinical disease models. Is it clear? Any questions so far? Okay, so you are able to measure both signal, you are able to get a lot of data, it's actually generating a lot of data. So you have to be equipped to be able to handle this data. But this is only the small part of the challenge. The real challenge comes when you try to make sense of this data. So analyzing fMRI data is a bigger challenge than collecting this data. Because if you have a good machine, and if you have good sequences, what you are, you know, using to collect data, then that basically quite straightforward. So you can you just have to control properly the behavior within the scanner. But now what you do with the data is completely up to you, and this is a very big challenge. So you can do very simple analysis of the data. Say you have an activation in the brain in one task, which is less the activation in a different task. Say light on, light off. And then you can simply, this is called the univariate approach, you can simply contrast these two conditions voxel-wise. So you basically take all the small elements, what you get, the voxels, and you do a t-statistics, and you compare them in one in the other condition, and you see whether there is a significant difference. So this is the simplest, and it has been dominating the field for 15 years. But recently, actually, this turned out to be, of course, very simplistic. So the field has moved towards more complicated analyses. And one is the multivariate, which assumes that the voxels in the brain, when they are activated, they are not independent. For the univariate analysis, the assumption is they are independent. Of course, they are not independent because they are driven by the bold response, which is connected to vessels and blood flow. Of course, it's not going to be independent. So now you can look for patterns of activations in the brain in two different tasks. Say, you see, color image and black and white image. So you can contrast that what is the color associated activation pattern in the field. And now you can use a lot of different image processing techniques, like, you know, linear discrimination, or support vector machines, or even lasso, or more sophisticated kind of. You probably learned about this in your courses of image processing. So basically, this moved the field towards very, you know, engineering approach, and now in the fMRI studies, a lot of informatics and all this kind of, you know, image processing specialists are involved, and this is a collaborative research. Now, so far we are talking about voxels, but how about their connections? Of course, we know that the brain is very specific because everything is connected. So neurons are neurons because they are connected and they provide information to each other about the states of the, you know, what they are being now. And of course, in fMRI, people were trying to understand how you can measure functional connectivities, interactions between the different voxels and the different regions in the brain. And many approaches have been proposed. But one of the most important is that it turned out that you can measure basically brain function in rest. So you don't have to give a task for the participant. You just ask the participant to lie in the scanner for 10 minutes doing nothing. The important thing is not to fall asleep, because that will disturb your acquisition. But anyway, so be motionless for 10 minutes and just don't try not to think about, you know, very specific things.
It turns out that even in rest, your brain is fully active. That's not new. We knew that from animal models. So there is no like switching off the brain. It's always active. And it turned out that this activation is not random. So there is a correlated activation between the regions which form a functional network. So say you can isolate in the rest those brain areas which are responsible for vision, and they will be different. This will be a different network from what is going to be engaged in audition or executive function or attention. So you can basically map or identify these brain networks during rest using functional connectivity. And here the measure is just correlation between the time courses of the signals in the different voxels. And they fluctuate, so you can see this is a fMRI signal. It's like in electrophysiology, it's not flat. It's always some spiking, some it's, of course, it's much slower than what you see in electrophysiology. But still, there's a nice pattern in the time course of the signal. And now you can simply use a zero-leg correlation and see how they are associated. And this was an extremely powerful method, and it's used now all over the world for the, we will come back to this more in a bit. Now, then of course you can do this correlation analysis and functional connectivity during the task. No reason why not to use it. You have to just keep in mind that this is a specific task. And then the most recent approach is using just the whole brain connectomics. So you basically do a whole brain model, and you combine structural and functional information, and you use graph theory or whatever you want to use. And so there is no limit for this. Of course, you have to be very careful when you interpret the data, because as soon as you have a lot of parameters and you have a lot of, you know, factors that you have to take care of, it's very difficult to understand what's basically the result. Yeah, as I mentioned, the functional rest connectivity is, especially since it measures brain activity during rest, you have to imagine how difficult it is to put together an experiment where you have to combine or compare the memory function of a normally aging person and a person with dementia. Now, it's a very hard task, because with dementia you get, of course, very poor memory performance. Now, if you cannot balance this memory performance within the two groups, or across the two groups, then you don't know what is the difference you are looking for. What is the difference you will get in this analysis? And that makes your work very hard, because you have to give a different task, a weaker, a less demanding task to the dementia patient. But then again, you don't know why is the difference than when you get. It's because it was a less demanding task, or the memory function was different. But now you have an approach where you just simply ask the patient and the control subject just to lie in the scanner, don't do anything. And it turns out that the intrinsic resting state brain connectivity nicely reflects what is the difference in the brain which might cause actually the symptoms of dementia. Now, as I mentioned, using this technique you can visualize, this is how it looks like when you visualize with this resting state fMRI, a brain network. So the easiest way to do is you take a seed region. So say you say that this is visual cortex, so the back of the head. This is the primary visual cortex. This is the calcarine sulcus. And you say, I'm interested in all the other voxels which correlate in their activity with the visual cortical seed, or the region which you choose. And then you, of course, get a nice, you know, activation, correlation activation map within this visual cortical network, and in other areas you don't see now in this slice actually. Now you can go for more sophisticated networks like the attentional network. So this is the network which helps your brain focus down on a specific task or a specific, you know, motor program. And you can see that the parietal and the frontal cortex, these very specific regions which are connected nicely during the rest and in correlated, which are known from monkey literature and human literature, that they are part of this attentional network. Also, what the nicest finding here was the discovery of the so-called default network in the brain. So it turned out that in the brain, as I said, there is never shut down. Brain is always active, and it turns out less task you have to do, this is the brain network. These are the regions which will increase their activation. So if you are asked to be, you know, motionless, don't do anything, just relax, this part of the brain, I mean this network of the brain, is going to rise its activity. And these are very crucial parts of the brain. So this is the cingulate cortex, the prefrontal cortex, the temporoparietal junction, which are known that if they are affected actually in any disease or in, you know, in stroke or in it's lesioned in an accident, you will get very, very, very big problems. And including memory, sensory, and all these diverse effects. So this is the housekeeper of your brain. So whenever you are not doing anything particularly, this is the network which organizes your thoughts, your prior experiments. So the brain has to take, it has to track all the events that happen to you, and they always have that the brain has to weight them according to its significance. So in the past, we are talking about the close part, I mean, not very far what happened, but just before you start relaxing, all these events will be evaluated by this network and assigned by weight, say this has to be stored for long-term memory. And this just, you know, let it go, it's not important. So these are the brain areas which organize all the brain functions. So it's absolutely critically important. And if you would do only activation studies, say what I see, what I hear, count, then you will not localize this region. So this turned out to be a very important technique, functional connectivity in rest, because it gives you a nice way to measure activity here. Okay, and of course you have to validate this technique, this functional, because first people were very skeptical. So this was discovered in back in, yes, back in a long time ago. Anyway, by Biswal in 95, I guess. So it's a long time ago. And there was a big gap. Nobody was taking serious with its resting state, fMRI connectivity method, because everybody thought that this might be some kind of artifact. What would that mean? That in, you know, in rest, you get this, all this information, I mean, this network. But since then, especially recently, yeah, 95, this one, that was the original description of this method. By now we know a lot about this method, and a lot of electrophysiological studies have been performed to validate that this is a real network activity, what you get in the rest. It has been shown also that it is associated with oscillatory activity in the brain. So there is a nice correlation, positive correlation with the gamma band oscillation and the negative correlation with alpha and beta band oscillation in the brain regions. And that has been done and shown in monkey simultaneous electrophysiology and fMRI measurements. And very importantly, using patients, I mean, using recordings in patients with epileptic seizures, you probably heard about this, these sources of epileptic seizures have to be localized. And for this, invasive technique is used. They can be different, but the point is that implanted electrodes are used to detect the origin and the source of this epileptic activity. And in patients where the electrodes were put on the ventral surface of the brain, and these are the two regions you can see in the resting state activity, they come out as a default mode network, the anterior and the posterior cingular cortex. If you have electrodes there, you can show in humans that there is indeed an oscillatory activity, and it's connected, it's correlates between them. So this is a direct demonstration that what you are measuring with fMRI indeed reflects some physiological processes which might be important. Now, so we have the fMRI, we have these different techniques you use for fMRI measurements, and using the visual system, I'm going to show you how you apply basically this method and how you can use it to study brain functions. So we use a lot of visual tasks in our experiments and our research because we are interested in how the visual, you know, brain is working. We are so-called visual animals. You probably heard that many times already. So almost half of our brain is somehow concerned with vision. So it's very different from rats. You can blind the rat and it's going to be just as efficient as with their eyes, still open or functioning. We humans are very much dependent on our visual system. And it makes it very important because in many diseases, actually, like schizophrenia, hallucinations, most of the hallucinations are visual. And all the, you know, problems with autism, with face recognition, you might heard this, that one of the major important deficits in autism spectrum disorder is actually the inability to code emotional information from faces. And that gives you a very social impairment, a very strong social impairment, which blocks your development basically and will give rise to many different other symptoms. So, vision is very important, we are studying it, so what is vision? So as I said already, this is the brain. This is if you cut the brain to two halves, and you are looking at it from the medial part, so from inside. So this is the view of the brain you never see when you look from any other side. So this is the corpus callosum, so these are the fibers which connect the basically, this is the track between the two hemispheres. It's very massive. You can imagine these are all myelinated fibers connecting these two. This is the cortex, these are the subcortical structures, and this is the cerebellum. So the back side of the brain here is the visual cortex, the classical visual cortex. It extends also laterally, so this is medial lateral. But this is the sulcus, the calcarine sulcus, where you have the visual cortex, the V1, the so-called, I don't know, have you had any lectures about vision before? So you know the basic, you know, anatomy, functional, blah, blah, blah. Should I go into the details so you know this? Okay. No, so briefly just to understand you, okay? But when we are talking about fMRI, we are talking about basically areas. These are big populations of neurons which somehow show a very a similar functional characteristics. And you can isolate these functional specific regions by measuring the responses. So say if you have an area which is sensitive for motion, we will see an example later, so for visual motion. We have in the brain a so-called middle temporal cortical area, which is actually contains 90% of the cells there will be direction selective. So they will fire differently depending on how your object is moving in the environment. So if it goes up, a part of the, you know, cells is going to fire, it goes left, another. And from this you can basically calculate and decode the direction of the motion in your environment. So this is what we are talking, the functional area, where you have all these cells which can code this specific feature, this property. Now, you can identify this region and prove that they are indeed specified is that if you make a lesion in this specific motion selective area, then the monkeys will be impaired in tasks where they have to detect the motion of the objects. This has been done many, many times. So they basically, we have, unfortunately in human, there is this symptom called akinetopsia, which is extremely rare. It is caused usually by an accident when, you know, something hits your head in a specific region. And akinetopsia is actually a very strange state Because what the patient sees is basically snapshots. So they don't see a continuous motion. What they see, an image here, 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 but no connection, but it was a motion. So that proves nicely that there are the specific, functionally specific areas in the brain. And again, of course, a very nice demonstration in animals. You can basically put an electrode, you activate the cells in this motion selective region, and the monkeys will report that, okay, I saw a motion in this direction. If you put another place in that region, they will see this direction. So basically, they are very different, direct demonstrations that you have functional specificity in these areas. So the problem is that we have very many of these areas in the brain. So this is the macaque brain. As I said, almost half of the macaque brain is involved in vision. So these are the exclusively visual regions, or more or less exclusive. But in the frontal cortex, there are big patches of, you know, cortical tissue which are very strongly connected to vision, to eye movement regulation, and of course visual working memory, and so on and so on. Now, if you take, there are more than 30 of these areas in the monkey, and if you just make a simple wiring of this, because everything is connected with everything in the brain, that's a bad news. But there are some basic laws, like closer areas which are closer to each other, they will be more strongly connected than areas which are, you know, further. So you can basically evade this connection. But anyway, this is just to show how complex, you know, network we are talking about when we are talking about visual cortical system. Now, the past 25 or 30 years, especially during the 90s and the early 2000s, this was a golden age of monkey electrophysiology. So there were a lot of groups in the world, and the primary, you know, focus was on vision, because monkeys are also visual animals. And we know a lot about these visual areas, how they function, how they are connected. And when the fMRI studies started, okay, I will come back to this. So when in the beginning of, you know, in the middle of 90s, when fMRI started to progress, and a lot of people started to use fMRI, the first question was, okay, how can I validate, or how can I use this knowledge in the monkeys to show that in the human brain, first, we have a very similar visual network, and second, that you can map it with fMRI, just as, you know, it was possible to do with electrophysiology model. Just before going to the fMRI, another very important organization principle in the visual cortex, that you can basically differentiate these visual cortical areas based on the hierarchical stage they are at. And we can identify low-level cortical areas, so V1, V2, these are the early visual cortical areas. These receive the input from the thalamus, from the lateral geniculate. They have very small receptive fields, first of all. And small, you know what is receptive? So each cell in the sensory cortical areas, or thalamus, or retina, has a small window, which is actually the only window they perceive the environment. So if we are talking about vision, so each cell codes a very small region of the visual field. In the V1, it's 1 degrees, which means that like your knee kneels in this distance. So it's very, very, very small region. So the whole coding of the visual field is very fragmented and very local. Now, if you go up to the higher level regions, like the intermediate or high level regions, your receptive fields are increasing. They can be half of the visual field in the infratemporal cortex. And the selectivity is not, you know, for orientation or motion direction, but for objects. So in this region, you can object selective. These are complex motion selective regions, like, you know, biological motion. And from this, you can say the whole visual system is organized in a way that you have a pass, or you have a module which codes what you see in the environment. So this is basically object recognition. And another visual pathway or module which will code how this information is moving into your visual field and how are the spatial relationship between visual objects in the video. Now this can be nicely shown both in monkey experiments and humans. So these are the early experiments by Mishkin and Angerreiter. So they made a lesion in the monkey in the ventral stream, which is for object recognition. And when there was a task to indicate whether it's a triangle or the square, the monkey was unable to do it. So they were not able to differentiate these two objects. But when the lesion in another group of monkeys was in the parietal lobe and the dorsal stream, they were unable to perform a task to say whether this object is closer to the left object or to the right object. So they could dissociate with lesion studies these two pathways. Anyway, this can be nicely shown also in patients. There is a very famous patient, DF, with object agnosia. This is a very devastating condition when you ask a subject with object agnosia, that means that they don't perceive objects, that's the rotting verb. You ask them to draw an apple and you give a model. This is what they have to draw, this is what they copy. So they're completely unable to identify that this is an apple. But if you ask them to draw an apple from memory, they are actually quite okay. So this is how they copy this object and this is how they draw an apple from memory. So that means that if your ventral visual system is damaged, then you won't have any or very poor visual object recognition. But that doesn't mean that your memory is completely gone. So you can see that you can do, these patients can do quite nice drawings from memory. This is for the book the same. Now in another patient, it's still DF. So you can even see this with a task where you ask the patient to indicate. So this is a box, a post box, and they have to indicate the orientation of the gap on the post. And what you can see that the control will say, okay, this is the orientation, and they have no clue what is the orientation of the post. But when you ask this patient DF to post actually a letter or a book or put something in, they are quite okay, so they can nicely perform the task. So basically they don't have a perceptual, you know, they don't see the gap on the post box, but they can perform a visually guided movement. So basically, just making this short, there are a lot of electrophysiological and human studies showing that the basic organization of the visual system in the brain is that you have hierarchically organized regions with more complex and larger receptive fields, and there is these two pathways. One is for object recognition, and one is for motion and spatial relationships. Okay, so this was all known before this fMRI field has started to grow and develop. So the question was, how can we now use this information to prove that fMRI is a good method and you can study vision in vivo in humans? Now, the first experiment was about retinotopy. Retinotopy means that in your early visual cortical areas, the spatial relationship between objects is preserved. So if you have an object here and an object here, the representation in the brain will keep this spatial information. This can be nicely shown if you take a monkey, this is the visual cortex of the monkey, you give a task for the monkey, you don't give any task actually, that just you require or stabilize the gaze of the monkey in the fixation point, and you have this checkerboard pattern, which is just on off black and white, you know, patterns, and these are actually anesthetized monkeys, so you do this stimulation for a long time, then the poor monkey will not survive this experiment. And if you take an autoradiography of the cortex of the monkey, you see that the metabolic activation pattern is actually nicely mimics or nicely maps all the spatial arrangement of the stimulus. So you can, this is striking. So you have a visual cortical representations which has the same spatial topical organization as your input. So this is what we call topographic or retinotopic organization. Okay, so you can now use fMRI to see whether you have the same retinotopic organization in the human visual cortex. Of course, you cannot do the same experiment because this patient and the subject has to survive this experiment. So what you do an activation. So now the subject is required to fixate here. And you have like a, you know, like a cake with different black and white regions, which is moving circular at a given speed. Or you have a ring which is expanding and contracting. And now you can track the activation in the visual cortex and see where it correlates with different positions of this pattern in the visual field. So basically you can map the spatial relationship within the visual cortex according to the stimulus presentation. And basically this is what you can, this is, you know, just a demonstration, but this is what you get. So this is the visual cortex, but now it's, you can do anything with the human visual cortex because it's of course just an image of this cortex. So you can unfold, so you cut basically the carcharine sulcus and you unfold it, this cortical sheet, and you basically, this is the ventral visual field, so this is the fixation, everything is below is the ventral, everything is above the dorsal, this is the left, this is the right. So then you can get an activation in the ventral representation, which will move down in the cortex. So basically you can nicely show this topographic organization of the visual cortex. So these are the different stripes which then indicate the borders of the different visual cortical areas. So this is what you can get with the retinotopic mapping in the visual cortex. So it nicely shows that just as we know from the monkeys, the human visual cortex, the early human visual cortex, is nicely topographically, retinotopically organized. It's very important because only this can allow you to localize objects precisely in your environment. So when you are picking up an object, this is the code what is used for localizing this object. Now, of course you can go further, and as I said, there are these feature-specific cortical region. This is the MT, the medial temporal cortex, what I mentioned, which is selected for visual motion. And if you give a stimulus which moves, then stops, you can basically easily localize this small region in the brain using functional MRI. And you can go further and you can localize object-specific regions, and of course the most important object, as I already mentioned, is the objects are faces. So basically you can localize the brain network or the brain areas which are specifically involved in the processing of faces. And this is the, I don't know whether you can see it, so this is the lateral view of the brain, this is the medial, and this is when you look at from below, and in the temporal flow there is this very important region, the FFA, the fusiform, this is the fusiform gyrus, fusiform face area, which is actually the major region for face processing. So if there is a lesion in this place due to accidents or strokes, then you will get the well-known, you might have seen in movies, they will even movies on this, so you get this well-known symptom of prosopagnosia. So prosopagnosia means that you don't, that the patient doesn't perceive faces, even their own faces, so they cannot recognize even their own faces if there is a region. Now, if you importantly, you have the same region in monkeys, so monkey has also a face region, and if you put electrodes there in monkeys, you will see that almost all of the cells are actually selectively firing or activating when you present a face as compared to another image. So in humans, using fMRI, you can nicely localize this. And of course, the field has been growing very fast, and now you have all these strange small regions in the brain dedicated to different small objects, I mean different object categories. Now, this is 2004. I think the view has changed. It's more like weights. So you have a network of visual cortical areas with different weight of specialization. And of course, you can see some biases in this region for, you know, giving higher responses to specific object categories, but this is not exclusive. Of course, each region will react or activate to some degree for a flash if there is a visual. So it's not straightforward that they are specialized exclusively for these objects, but they are, you know, more or less giving more response to different type of objects. What is the strongest specialization and the strongest, you know, so far what we have seen is the face selective region in the brain. That's absolutely consistently you can localize with fMRI. We use it in our experiments. So basically, not only that functional MRI has confirmed the monkey, you know, electrophysiological results and organization of the visual cortex. Now we know a lot about the human visual cortex, how it is organized, how is the hierarchy, and what are the specific areas which are involved in different tasks. Okay, so far, what time is it? Okay. So far we are talking about how to use fMRI to map. Should we have a break now? Yeah, okay. How long is that? It's 3 times 1 hour, so 45 minutes. Yeah. Okay, so let's have 5-10 minutes of break and then.